guys, today this is going to be a little bit different. I'm going to read to you a lot. We've been going through a series on Heroes of the Faith, and Dad and Tim asked me if I would like to speak on one of my Heroes of the Faith, and I said, well, sure, because I like to talk. And so that reminds me, I'm looking at the clock right now. I'm at 10:50. We'll try and keep this at least within 24 hours. So I thought to myself, well, who's one of my heroes of the faith? C.S. Lewis is. And so I said, well, I'm going to do C.S. Lewis, because that would give me a chance to research him more. And what I found out was absolutely fascinating. The guy did not have that interesting of a life. He wrote. And when you're going to talk about C.S. Lewis, you talk about his writings, not his life. I watched a documentary on him, and they scoured the world, and they only found 38 pictures of the guy in existence. His life just wasn't, it was just a normal life. It was a good life, it was a fine life. It wasn't like the other heroes that we've been talking about in terms of all the things that they were able to accomplish. But his writings were incredible. So let's go ahead and pray here first, and I'll have to organize. God, your word tells us that unless you build the house, they labor in vain that try to build it at all. Lord, and I just think of sitting here with the opportunity to share some thoughts with my friends, God, and I'm thinking about the logistics. Am I prepared enough? Do I know what I want to say? Am I organized? All these kind of things. God, it doesn't matter. Lord, we have a chance. We're all here, and this gives us an opportunity to hear from you and have you speak into our individual lives what you want us to hear. And I just pray that you would use this time that we have here this morning. Help it to be organized. And logical and coherent and understandable, useful to all of us here. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so naturally to begin, I don't want to talk about C.S. Lewis. What I learned about C.S. Lewis, I really want to tie into maybe the most expensive lesson I've ever learned so far in my life. There are probably more expensive ones coming, but this has been the hardest one in my life. So I want to think for a second here about society. When you think about how we live here in this culture, there are some themes that I notice. One is follow your heart. Another, chase your dreams. If you go into any restaurant or any kind of retail place, the idea is have it your way. If you watch movies or TV, any of these things, there's often this phrase, I've never felt this way about anything before. And the insinuation is, because I haven't, then I should do whatever it is. I mean, I've never felt this way. I've heard this one a lot around, I still have feelings for you. And I've heard this one a lot. I should, whatever X is, but I really don't feel like it. And The sum total of all this is just this idea. I think it's very pervasive in our culture that what I feel, as long as I feel it strongly enough, I'm not saying if I have a whim, I go and do that, but if I feel it strongly enough, it becomes true. This is reality. This is what I need to act on. That's how I lived for quite a while, and it ran me into some very, very difficult, as I said, the hardest place I've ever been in my life. I'm not going to tell you that story today, but here's some of the things I thought about as I was kind of working through this. I want you to imagine this story. I made my own parable. I hope it's not heretical. But there was a couple that got married. They had this fantastic wedding. They'd been in love for, who knows, however many years. And they got married. All their friends came. It was perfect. I mean, the weather was perfect. The decorations were perfect. Everybody was there. And the wedding ceremony went off flawlessly, and then everyone moved to the reception at a different location. And in that reception, I mean, before everyone had arrived, but people are getting there, and the place is just buzzing. It's bustling with excitement. And everyone's having a great time, and then suddenly someone runs into the reception with a very distraught look on their face, and they say, I'm sorry, everyone, please, I need your attention. I'm sorry, but there's been a horrible accident. I'm sorry. And they turn to the bride, and they say, your parents got hit by a car on the way over here, and it was terrible timing, but you're going to need to come with us. We don't have a whole lot of time. And the bride stood up with a smile and with a laugh in her eyes. She said, you're too late! You see, I've always known that when I got married, I would be happy forever. I'm locked in. There's nothing you can do to upset me. Her parents may pass away, but that's just it. She felt something so strongly, she'll never not feel it again, right? She's going to be happy for the rest of her life. Does that make sense? Obviously not. If that were possible, and if that even happened, it would be completely inappropriate. That's not sorry, things happen. We've got to be able to be sorry. What I'm saying is our emotions must be able to change. As I thought about it, emotions to me now, what I compare them to is the nervous system, right? We have nerves in our body, and they all get interpreted in our brain. So if I feel something in my arm, there are synapses and different neurons, and they send a message, and they just tell my brain, hey, something is touching your arm. And that's all they do is just relay the message. Now, if I slap myself on the arm, I feel a mild discomfort. My brain interprets that, mild discomfort, okay? If my arm gets snapped in half, my brain will send the message as strongly as it possibly can. This hurts. You're going to want to know that. And whatever you were doing that got you here, like, you're going to want to not be doing that anymore. Right? But here's the thing. Both of those messages pass away. They're supposed to. The stronger messages take longer to pass away. But they're supposed to pass away. And if they don't, something is wrong. It's a disorder of some kind. See what I'm saying? Are you following, tracking with that? So emotions are similar. They help us to interpret the situations that we're in, but they're not the definition of it. And I think in culture, the way I felt before, the way I feel like a lot of the people I'm around feel, is just like, if I can just get to this pinnacle so that I can feel this thing strongly enough, then I'll be happy for the rest of my life. That's not even what emotions are supposed to do. And we'd be in real trouble if we actually got happy for the rest of our lives. You understand? Because sad things happen. Okay? So what I boiled that all down to is this. Emotions are wonderful sails, but they're terrible anchors. You just can't base your life on emotions. And we need a better foundation. And that's what I really found in C.S. Lewis. I read from him, mainly I want to focus on his autobiography. He absolutely did not want to be a Christian. Why did he become a Christian? Because emotions aren't the things that define our lives. So, let's dig in here. I want to give you a little bit of a character sketch of him. He was by no means an extrovert. He spent most of his life in academia. He spoke of his earlier life. He said this about being invited to a party. He said, "I had, of course, no notion of the social nexus. I never realized that certain people were in civility obligated to ask me to a party because they knew my father or had known my mother. To me, it was all inexplicable, unprovoked persecution. And when, as often happened, such engagements fell in the last week of the holidays and wrested from us a huge cantle of hours in which every minute was worth gold, I positively felt that I could have torn my hostess limb from limb. Why should she thus pester me? I had never done her any harm, never invited her to any parties." Later in life, he still had a similar sentiment regarding other people. He said, "Hence, while friendship has been by far the chief source of my happiness, acquaintance or general society has always meant little to me. And I cannot quite understand why a man should wish to know more people than he can make real friends of." Social butterfly, right? He also outlined in the book what his ideal day would look like. This I thought was interesting. Notice how much it involves people. 8 a.m. sharp, we're going to have breakfast. At 9 o'clock, you'll be at your desk. From 9 until 1, you're either reading or writing. If tea or coffee could be brought at 11, so much the better. 1 p.m. precisely, lunch should be on the table. Eat for an hour. From 2 p.m. to 4:15, out for a walk. Return home to tea again, and from 4:15 to 5 p.m., you have a tea meal with light reading. He said this should be more a gossipy, formless kind of reading, not heavy reading like poetry, something like the newspaper. Read that, and then from 5 to 7, you're back at work. At 7 p.m., you have dinner and conversation. He said this, and unless you are making a night of it with your cronies, and every man should have cronies, he didn't have any at this point in his life, but unless you're making a night of it with your cronies, there is no reason why you should ever be in bed later than 11. One other tidbit that I thought was interesting was he said this, and it is an essential of the happy life that a man would have almost no mail and never dread the postman's knock. Seems like a good idea. Early in his life, there were some important concepts, ones that I just want to draw out. His autobiography is called Surprised by Joy. He described joy, and I'll read to you his definition of it, but I think I'll have to supplement it. He said this, it is that of an unsatisfied desire, which is itself more desirable than any other satisfaction. Who understands? It's almost like nostalgia in reverse. If you feel nostalgic, you're looking back to something that you can no longer have. Maybe it was a time, or it was an event, or it was something. You're looking back at something that it's not accessible anymore. And you partially feel bad because it's not accessible anymore, but also remembering it brings you tremendous joy. You know what I mean? There's this huge welling up of bittersweet. That familiar? And what he's talking to is that same feeling, but forward. Somewhere out there is this bittersweet feeling. And you don't know quite what it is, and you don't know. It makes you happy just thinking that it could be there, but also sad because it's not here. That makes sense? That's what he means by joy. So joy is going to have a little bit of a different meaning when we reference it here. Oh, goodness, that's 10 minutes. So there's another thing that plays into that. It's this idea of limited liabilities. He explained this about his temperament, and I thought it was just incredible. Incredible. Right here. No. Oh dear, that's the wrong page. Huh. He said basically that he always liked limited liabilities in his life. So what he said, he would prefer to be much neglected by people around him than to be interfered with. He would prefer bland food to food that had been poorly seasoned. He would prefer, there were a couple others. Do you see the theme there? He'd much rather not have anything than to have something with a little bit of pain. And that actually extrapolated in his life into this idea. He would prefer to have not existed at all than to have existed and experienced even a modicum of pain in his life. That was part of his mindset and things. In his early life, however, he was religious. However, it was very difficult for him to enjoy it. I want to read this portion to you of how his faith just became burdensome to him. That like everyone else, I had been told as a child that one must not only say one's prayers, but think about what one was saying. Accordingly, when I came to a serious belief, I tried to put this into practice. At first, it seemed plain sailing. But soon the false conscience came into play. One had no sooner reached amen than it whispered, yes. But are you sure you were really thinking about what you said? Then, more subtly, were you, for example, thinking about it as well as you did last night? The answer, for reasons I did not then understand, was nearly always no. Very well, said the voice. Hadn't you then better try it over again? And one obeyed, but of course with no assurance that the second attempt would be any better. To these nagging suggestions, my reaction was, on the whole, the most foolish I could have adopted. I set myself a standard. No clause of my prayer was to be allowed to pass muster unless it was accompanied by what I called a realization, by which I meant a certain vividness of the imagination and the affections. See how there's a little bit of feeling in there? Got to feel it. I got to really be into it or it's not right. It says this, my nightly task was to produce by sheer willpower a phenomenon which willpower could never produce. which was so ill-defined that I could never say with absolute confidence whether it had occurred, and which, even if it did occur, was of very mediocre spiritual value. If you had a faith, and that was the context you had your faith in, you would be frustrated. He got frustrated, and he met a woman at a school who was in the process of finding herself spiritually as well, and she would just kind of stream of consciousness say what she was thinking. But what she was thinking was asking questions. She hadn't really found her own answers yet, and those questions bred in Lewis doubt. He said this, "The whole thing became a matter of speculation. I was soon, in the famous words, altering, I believe, to one does feel, feel. And oh, the relief of it." There's an emotion, right? It was very relieving to be done. From the tyrannous noon of revelation, I passed into the cool evening twilight of higher thought, where there was nothing to be obeyed and nothing to be believed except what was either comforting or exciting. I asked Melissa if that sounded like college to her. She said, I went to Iowa in the liberal arts, I'm telling you. Higher thought, that's what we get. I mean, think anything you want, be excited about anything, but goodness, try and stand for something concrete. That's not right. Higher thought. That's what it's about. And then, just a little bit later, he recorded this. And so, little by little, with fluctuations which I cannot now trace, I became an apostate, dropping my faith with no sense of loss, but with the greatest relief. It just fit him, right? It felt right. But it didn't last. This stayed for a very, very long time. Lewis was late in his life. Oh, he was later in his life. I believe he was in his 30s when he came back and realized that Christ was the fulfillment of everything that was going on. So for a long time there in his life, this was how he thought. But eventually, by being honest, conflicts arose. I want to read you this quote. This is fascinating to me. Really, and this is one of the reasons that Lewis is my hero. He said this, "What I like about experience is that it is such an honest thing. You may take any number of wrong turnings, but keep your eyes open and you will not be allowed to go very far before the warning signs appear. You may have deceived yourself, but experience is not trying to deceive you. The universe rings true wherever you fairly test it." And this is the thing. Lewis knew what he would like to believe. But he was honest enough to keep on questioning. Does this really make sense? Does this really add up? And eventually, some things came to light that perhaps it was not. This is an interesting quote. One of the things that sort of caught him. He said, "I was at this time living, like so many atheists or anti-theists, in a whirl of contradictions. I maintained that God did not exist. I was also very angry with God for not existing. I was equally angry with him for creating a world." So you see that God cannot exist at one point and he exists for the other two arguments. God's not real because I'm angry at him. It's a whirl of contradictions. He said more on this, and I thought, interestingly, there's a point where he just realizes that what this means, if I'm believing this, there are reasons for it as well. He said, "To such a craven, the materialist's universe had the enormous attraction that it offered you limited liability." Remember, that was a big deal for him. "No strictly infinite disaster could overtake you in it. Death ended all, and if ever finite disasters proved greater than one wished to bear, suicide would always be possible. The horror of the Christian universe was that it had no door marked exit. It was also perhaps not unimportant that the externals of Christianity made no appeal to my sense of beauty. Oriental imagery and style largely repelled me, and for the rest, Christianity was mainly associated for me with ugly architecture, ugly music, and bad poetry. But of course, what mattered most of all was my deep-seated hatred of authority, my monstrous individualism, my lawlessness. No word in my vocabulary expressed deeper hatred than the word interference. But Christianity, placed at the center, what then seemed to me a transcendental interferer. And just a few sentences later, he says this, though. He just admits it. But the difficulty of explaining even a boy's thought entirely in terms of his wishes is that on such large questions as these, he always has wishes on both sides. If you're going to take God out of the picture, there's no purpose for anything. It would be nice to have purpose, but if you're going to acknowledge purpose, then you have to acknowledge God, and then there's an interferer. You've got wishes on both sides. That was a beginning point. And he just noted it, and then time went on. And there was another realization. As he got deep into college, his friends began to kind of ask questions, and this brought up even more difficulties. One thing he realized was that he had what his friend showed him. He called it chronological snobbery. He described it this way: it's the uncritical acceptance of the intellectual climate common to our own age, and the assumption that whatever has gone out of date is on that account discredited. That it's not. You have to find out why it went out of date. Was it really illegitimate, or did fads just change? He said, from seeing this, one passes to the realization that our own age, I think this is a big deal, our own age is also a period. It will be looked back on by future generations as a period, and certainly has, like all periods, its own characteristic illusions. They are likeliest to lurk in those widespread assumptions which are so ingrained in the age that no one dares to attack or feels it necessary to defend them. We just take it for granted. Can you guys think of anything like that in our culture? Have you ever even tried to have a conversation about creation versus evolution? You just don't dare attack it, and no one even needs to defend it. It's just, we know this. Things like that. Chronological snobbery is just being uncritically accepting of the common views. And so, what that led to for Lewis was the fact that he needed to acknowledge an absolute, but it led to an impersonal religion. He started to believe in an absolute, but he said the emotion that went with all of this was certainly religious, but this was a religion that cost nothing. We could talk religiously about the absolute, but there was no danger of its doing anything about us. There was nothing to fear, better still, nothing to obey. But it was still a change. He began to realize an absolute. Then he ran into a guy named G.K. Chesterton, and he read a book by him. He said this: I read Chesterton's Everlasting Man, and for the first time saw the whole Christian outline of history set out in a form that seemed to me to make sense. Somehow I contrived not to be too badly shaken. You will remember that I already thought Chesterton the most sensible man alive, apart from his Christianity. Now, I veritably believe, I didn't, of course, say, words would have revealed the nonsense, that Christianity itself was very sensible, apart from its Christianity. Something else happened here. He noticed a change in joy. Remember that joy, well, let me just tell you what he said here. He said, joy is a desire. A desire is turned not to itself, but to its object. Not only that, but it owes all its character to its object. So he realized that this longing, what he was really looking for, he was looking for whatever actually gave him this feeling. But he realized that feeling is not the thing that I'm going for. The feeling is related to an object. What is that object? And so the understanding of what joy really was pushed him to go find object. The pursuit can't be the thing itself. Finally, very reluctantly, he realized that he had to admit that God was real. Okay? He said, people who are naturally religious find difficulty in understanding the horror of such a revelation. Amiable agnostics will talk cheerfully about man's search for God. To me, as I then was, they might as well have talked about the mouse's search for the cat. You must picture me alone in that room at Magdalene, night after night, feeling, whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. Let's see. He said this, though, too. I did not see then what is now the most shining and obvious thing, the divine humility which will accept a convert on such terms. The prodigal son at least walked home on his own feet. But who can duly adore that love which will open the high gates to a prodigal who is brought in kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting his eyes in every direction for a chance to escape? The hardness of God is kinder than the softness of men, and his compulsion is our liberation. It's interesting. Compulsion, you're all familiar with that word, means to be forced, to be compelled, almost against your will. C.S. Lewis acknowledged that he had a choice, but he said, I was forced to. I was forced into that choice. But after tasting and seeing, he saw that it was good. However, that, what he wrote, was to him just a conversion into theism. Now he believes there's a God. There's still the separate question of who that God is. And he went through everything. And I'm not going to go into the whole process, but he came down to essentially either Hinduism or Christianity. One of those two had to be the real. And then there were reasons that Hinduism were cut out. But here's what he says about Christianity. There was no such historical claim as in Christianity. I was blamed now, too experienced in literary criticism to regard the Gospels as myths. They had no mythical taste, and yet the very matter which they set down in their artless historical fashion, those narrow, unattractive Jews, too blind to the mythical wealth of the pagan world around them, was precisely the matter of great myth. If ever a myth had become fact, had been incarnated, it would be just like this. And nothing else in all literature was just like this. Myths were like it in one way, histories were like it in another, but nothing was simply like it, and no person was like the person it depicted. Here and here only, in all time, the myth must have become fact, the world, the word, flesh, God, man. This is not a religion, nor a philosophy. It is the summing up in actuality of them all. And that was part of C.S. Lewis's thing. One of the reasons he didn't believe in Christianity was because he just put it in the target with myth. He lumped it together in the same thing as myth. He said Christianity is just another myth. But what really persuaded him was conversations that led him to believe that all myths point to parts of the truth. The question is, was there ever one myth which was the truth, which fully realized, basically it was the mature expression of every other implication? And that's what he realized, was that Christianity was that. So that's when he became a Christian. And he said after that, that once he found God, joy, which he'd been looking for his whole life, was just no longer important because he realized God was the object. And he said, so I want God. That's what I want. And joy, he said it still happened to him. He still had those feelings. They still visited him, but they just didn't have the same value. He realized that God was what he was really after the whole time. So what I love about Lewis, just the conclusion here, is that feelings must be surrendered to truth. Then they find their true worth. Truth is a good anchor. Emotions are wonderful sails, but truth has to be the anchor. Otherwise, our feelings, they can't take us anywhere consistently. Right? And the rest, as you know, is history. Lewis then went to work for God. He used all his talents. He used who he was. He was still an introvert. He didn't become an extrovert. He used his studies. He used his writings to share what he now believed was true. I do want to visit briefly. In less than 200 words, Lewis said this about Jesus, and it's just incredible. It's another one of those things. We all have to make our choice. about who Jesus is. It's called the Lord Liar Lunatic thing. He said this: I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, on a level with a man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great moral, a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Again, however you feel, we've got to make our choice. We've got to make our choice based on truth, not based on how we feel. In closing, I just want to share this one verse with you because I want this to become applicable into us. Dad has mentioned a couple times this verse, 2 Chronicles 7:14. And several of us pray for this each day. But this is what God told the Israelites. He said, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and I will heal their land. One thing I want to point out about this verse, I've just been thinking about this, I think this is big. When we first started praying about this, I was like, oh man, how are we going to get our whole nation to start thinking this way? And I realized we don't need the whole nation. This just says, if my people who are called by my name. So God's not asking for the atheists to turn to him. He's asking for just us. If we really say that we want to follow God with our lives, then that's us. If we will humble ourselves, pray, seek his face, and turn from our wicked ways, then he'll heal hear from heaven and he'll heal our land. What does that mean other than we have things caught up with us that are not pleasing to God? We have wicked ways that we haven't turned from. We have things that we haven't repented from. We haven't humbled ourselves. And I just think this goes along with a culture that says, well, I feel how we feel needs to be how we make our decisions. It shouldn't be so for us. If we want to follow God, if we really understand what a Lord is, we don't need Jesus just to be saved. We need Jesus to be the Lord. And all of a sudden, it doesn't matter. Oh, I think this movie is fine. What does God think? What are God's standards? And let him change me. You see what I'm saying? This is something that we should grab onto, I think, because God wants us to be holy and distinct. And if we just manage ourselves, if we stop defending the things that all of us have in our lives, if we will submit and say, you're God in my life, and I'll follow and I'll obey, then we can get the blessings that God promised. So my final point is just this question. God, I've learned in my experience so far with me, God has not been a jerk. He's been extremely patient. And if there were a bajillion different things in my life that he could have pointed to and said, these are all terrible, he's been good enough to me to only point out one or two at a time and say, I just want you to work on this. And so the thing I want to challenge us with this week is just, what is one thing we can work on this week to more fully surrender our wills and our emotions to walk in obedience with the truth? God is Lord. How might he want to change you? What might he want to bring out of your life? And I will say that as much as I've been able to surrender and as much change as I've let God make in my life, I've become really proud of it. It's a good thing. Wow, like, I don't do this or that anymore. And it's good. There's always an agreement. So that's the idea. Let's go ahead and pray, and we'll wrap it up. God, I just thank you for the examples that you've given us to follow, Lord. And I thank you. I also think about just what the end goal is. Your kingdom comes back, Lord, and your paradise, your heaven, is uncompromised. It's absolutely perfect there. And as much as I stand condemned by perfection, I'm still attracted to it. Lord, if I could be in heaven, I would want it to be a perfect place. But if I went into heaven as I am right now, unchanged, it would not be a perfect place anymore. You want to change us. You must change us. You develop us, God. And we're not going to get all the way there in this life. But Lord, I just pray. I pray that we would be humble and that we would look at you not as our genie, not as somebody that we just, yeah, great, I'm forgiven, I can do whatever I want now. But just realizing, and really just out of gratitude and in pursuit of a relationship with you, just step by step, we would be willing to be led by you into obeying you a little bit more today, and a little bit more today, and a little bit more. Thank you for the chance to remember this, God. I just pray that you would just lead us day by day. Help us to know what we can do to grow in you. And I pray that we would be able to feel. Eric Little said, God made me fast. When I run, I feel his pleasure. And I pray that we would be able to feel how happy you are with us as we obey more and more, surrender more and more, and let you make us into the people you think. Ask all these things in Jesus' name.